ask me who's in charge, because I'll give you an answer and it'll be very controversial.
What does that mean?
It means we're in charge.
We're in charge, President Trump tells reporters asking about Venezuela. But again, what does that mean?
It's Monday, January 5th, and this is All Things Considered from NPR News.
Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Juana Summers. Venezuela's ousted president, Nicolas Maduro, was in a New York courtroom today.
So was our reporter. She'll fill us in on how it went.
Also this hour, what does this moment feel like for Venezuelans?
We reached an independent journalist in the capital, Caracas.
One thing is taking away the dictator of the country. Another thing is having the Venezuelan dictatorship end.
Plus the latest from Minnesota, where Governor Tim Walz is dropping his bid for re-election.
I came to the conclusion that I can't give a political campaign my all.
Those stories and more after these news headlines.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Ryland Barton. Venezuela's ousted president, Nicolas Maduro, pleaded not guilty to drug trafficking and other charges during a hearing in New York City today. Meanwhile, the country's vice president was sworn in as interim president. NPR's Carrie Kahn has more.
Delcy Rodriguez was actually sworn in as what they're calling the acting or interim president. She was sworn in by her brother, who is the longtime head of the assembly, and here she is.
Para sacar adelante a Venezuela.
She pledged to bring Venezuela out of these terrible times that she says is threatening the stability and peace of our country. She really has toned down her rhetoric, though, since President Trump threatened her directly if she didn't come in line with U.S. demands. And so clearly what we saw today, though, was the old guard is still in charge of Venezuela. There has been no big shakeup after the U.S. attack.
NPR's Carrie Kahn reporting. Secretary of State Marco Rubio will discuss the Venezuela situation this evening with the Gang of Eight congressional leaders, including top members of the intelligence committees. Democrats called for the briefing after Congress was largely kept in the dark about the surprise operation. And President Trump is now threatening military action against Colombia. NPR's Franco Ordonez has more.
President Trump told reporters Sunday that a military operation in Colombia, quote, sounded good to him.
Colombia is very sick, too, run by a sick man who likes making cocaine and selling it to the United States. And he's not going to be doing it very long.
The threat is just the latest in a running war of words between Trump and the Colombian president, Gustavo Petro, which has been escalating since the Trump administration's military campaign striking alleged drug boats in the Caribbean. Petro responded to Trump's threat in a long social media post, warning that arresting a president would, quote, unleash a popular jaguar. He added that he's asked the Colombian people to defend their president from any violence against him. Franco Ordonez, NPR News.
Secretary of Defense Pete Hegseth is taking administrative action against Senator Mark Kelly. NPR's Quill Lawrence reports it comes after the Democrats spoke out against President Trump.
Senator Kelly served 25 years as a Navy pilot and retired with full military benefits, so he's still subject to military code. Secretary Hegseth claims that Kelly's statements, including a message telling troops not to follow illegal orders, amount to sedition. Hegseth says on social media that he's initiated a formal 45-day process to reduce Kelly's rank and retirement pay. Senator Kelly replied in a statement that he earned his rank in combat and as an astronaut, and that Hegseth and the Trump administration are trying to stifle free speech and dissent among retired military officers. Kelly called that outrageous and un-American. Quill Lawrence, NPR News.
Wall Street gained ground today, led by a mix of energy companies and banks. This is NPR News from Washington. Minnesota Governor Tim Walz has ended his reelection campaign after being dogged by reports of fraud in state-run social service programs. The 2024 Democratic vice presidential candidate says he has stepped up efforts to detect fraud, but the allegations consumed political discussion. Potential contenders to replace him as the Democratic nominee include U.S. Senator Amy Klobuchar. Some new coins begin circulating this week to mark the 250th anniversary of the nation's founding. NPR's Scott Horsley reports designs of some of the coins were altered by the Trump administration.
Congress authorized the anniversary coins back in 2021, and after years of polling and focus groups, a Citizens Advisory Committee recommended five anniversary quarter designs, including coins marking the abolition of slavery, the civil rights movement, and women's suffrage. But when the Trump administration recently unveiled the new coins, those those designs had been replaced with quarters featuring pilgrims, the Revolutionary War, and the Gettysburg Address. Donald Scorinci, who served on the advisory committee, was disappointed.
They stopped history at the Civil War. They just kind of said, okay, this series of quarters doesn't really reflect where we are 250 years later.
A spokeswoman for the Mint says some of the rejected designs could be revived later. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
A 535-pound bluefin tuna sold for a record $3.2 million at the first auction of 2026 at Tokyo's Toyosu Fish Market. The top bid broke the previous record set in 2019. The pricey fish was caught off the coast of Oma in northern Japan. You're listening to NPR News from Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Pew Charitable Trusts, telling stories behind data and trends that shape our world today through its podcast, After the Fact. Learn more at pewtrusts.org/afterthefact.
It is 4:06, and you're listening to All Things Considered here on KAXE KBXE. I'm Andrew DeZingle. We receive support from Hug Hydronics, committed to making in-floor heating simple, providing in-floor heating solutions for both commercial and residential. More information at hughydronics.com. Taking a look at the weather tonight, cloudy skies, overnight lows 15 to 20 degrees with a chance of widespread, dense, freezing fog. Now back to All Things Considered.
Things Considered from NPR News, I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. America First has been a key part of President Trump's political brand for more than a decade. His campaigns were built on rejecting American intervention in Iraq and Afghanistan and Libya. Then U.S. troops stormed into Venezuela and took the country's president, Nicolas Maduro, by force. NPR senior White House correspondent Tamara Keith reports on how the administration is explaining this apparent shift.
By the time President Trump was running for office in 2016, the Iraq War was widely seen as a mistake, and nation building in Afghanistan an expensive failure. In his stump speech, Trump often tapped into Americans' outrage about foreign wars.
We're not looking for regime change. We've learned that lesson a long time ago.
We're not looking for regime change. They've tried that. We must abandon the failed policy of nation building and regime change.
That was Trump speaking in 2019, 2020, and 2016. And again, as he ran to retake the White House in 2024, Trump made the same case against then-President Biden.
He sent our blood and treasure to back regime change in Iraq, regime change in Libya, regime change in Syria, and every other globalist disaster for half a century.
Then came Venezuela. This was Trump on Saturday announcing Maduro's arrest.
We are going to run the country until such time as we can do a safe, proper, and judicious transition.
Trump says there is currently no U.S. military presence on Venezuelan soil. Last night on Air Force One, he was asked about his assertion that the U.S. would be running the country.
Don't ask me who's in charge, because I'll give you an answer and it'll be very controversial.
What does that mean?
It means we're in charge.
We're in charge. To MAGA star turned apostate Marjorie Taylor Greene, Trump's operation in Venezuela is a contradiction of what he and the Make America Great Again movement stood for.
Now, I am not defending Maduro, and of course I'm happy for the people of Venezuela to be liberated, but Americans celebrated the liberation of the Iraqi people after Saddam Hussein. They celebrated the liberation of the Libyan people after Gaddafi.
Greene, who is retiring from Congress rather than continue to face the wrath of Trump, was interviewed on Sunday on NBC's Meet the Press.
And this is the same Washington playbook that we are so sick and tired of, that doesn't serve the American people, but actually serves the big corporations, the banks, and the oil executives.
Trump has said he wants U.S. companies to take over the management of Venezuela's oil industry. But aside from Greene, elected Republicans and MAGA influencers have largely fallen in line behind Trump. Alexander Gray was chief of staff for the White House National Security Council in Trump's first term. He says people misunderstand MAGA and America First as isolationist. Gray says MAGA doesn't like weakness or failure, and Venezuela, he argues, is very clearly in the national interest.
That's what he's prioritizing, is the defense of the homeland, defense of the hemisphere, and defending them from non-hemispheric powers. And Venezuela fits squarely in that bucket. I think this is very different from an Iraq or Afghanistan that were tangential to U.S. interests.
Gray predicts under Trump, you won't see the U.S. running the water system in Caracas, for instance. But it's really hard to know what will happen in Venezuela now that the U.S. has removed Maduro. Politically speaking, the Trump administration will own whatever comes next. Secretary of State Marco Rubio was on TV over the weekend trying to sell this to the American people, including a message that this is nothing like the interventionism Trump opposed as a candidate. Here he was on Meet the Press.
Venezuela looks nothing like Libya. It looks nothing like Iraq. It looks nothing like Afghanistan. It looks nothing like the Middle East other than the Iranian agents that are running through their plotting against America.
He said comparing this mission to the U.S. interventions in the Middle East and Afghanistan was like apples and oranges. Tamara Keith, NPR News.
With President Maduro and his wife being detained in New York, we want to understand how this moment feels for Venezuelans. We've reached independent journalist Gabriela Masonis Rojo in the capital city of Caracas. Welcome to All Things Considered.
Hi, Juana. Thank you so much for having me.
I'd like to start by asking you how you're doing and if you could just walk us through what this weekend was like for you.
The weekend was very silent after the whole bombing situation happened. Everything was pretty quiet. Aside from a couple of reports from colectivos in some popular areas, these reports are growing. Apparently today there has been huge presence of colectivos in the street. Apparently they are stopping people in the street, checking their cell phones, and what they're looking for is information on whether people approve the taking of Maduro.
And as you've been speaking to people, what has been top of mind from people that you've spoken with? How have they been reacting?
So people in Venezuela are very scared, actually. There's huge uncertainty on basic things, like are we going to find food to feed our families in the next couple of weeks? And of course, there's huge uncertainty on what's going to happen now. How is this transition going to look now? Of course, Chavista regime is still in place. So I think there are a lot of questions like, will there be a second bombing? Mm-hmm. What's going to happen to political prisoners? Are political detentions still going to take place? Of course, there are so many more questions. What's going to happen with our oil industry? What's going to happen with paramilitary groups? You know, if I had to summarize it in two words, I would say uncertainty and contradiction. Mm. It's also very contradictory because people are happy that Maduro was taken. People are happy that he's going to face justice. But of course, fear has been a huge part of Venezuela, especially the last year that we've seen a huge wave of repression. So the last year has been marked by fear. And I think that's a little bit the situation still.
Now, President Trump has said that the United States will run Venezuela, and Secretary of State Marco Rubio has offered some clues as to what that might mean, but we don't yet have a clear picture. Meanwhile, Maduro's vice president, Delcy Rodriguez, has been sworn in as interim president, and her brother is president of the National Assembly. And opposition leader Maria Corina Machado might be expected to have a role. And I understand that politically you identify as left-wing and Machado's party is more right-wing, but what have you heard from Venezuelans about the future of the government?
One thing is taking away the dictator of the country. Another thing is having the Venezuelan dictatorship end. And another thing is having a true transition to democracy with democratic values. Of course, most Venezuelans believe that this should include Maria Corina Machado and Edmundo González Urrutia, who were our elected leaders in what was probably Venezuela's most important democratic effort of the last year. Also, to give you some context, in the 2024 presidential elections, it was proven with the voting tallies that Maduro had stolen the election, basically. So ideally, what Venezuelans mostly wish is that this transition will include these elected political actors. However, it doesn't seem that it's going to be like that. Trump has barely mentioned Maria Corina and Edmundo. So I think this is the biggest uncertain point that we have at the moment. How is the government going to look, and what is going to be the role of political actors who took place in the last presidential election?
Gabriella, what do you think it's important for people here in the United States to keep in mind as the story continues to develop?
I think it's pretty important to understand that this is not necessarily an ideology left versus right issue. Venezuelan politics is it's complex and nuanced, and it has been particularly complicated in the past 25 years since Chavez took power in 1998. It has been more complicated since Maduro took power in 2013. And the last year has honestly been brutal for Venezuela. Venezuela has had an humanitarian emergency since 2014. Almost 8 million migrants and refugees have left the country. So I think what's really important is to understand that human rights should also be part of the conversation and not just a very biased left versus right conversation.
That is independent journalist Gabriella Misiones Rojo in Caracas, Venezuela. Thank you.
Thank you, Juana, for having me.
One of the NFL's fiercest rivalries took the field last night and added another chapter to the history books. The Pittsburgh Steelers faced off against the Baltimore Ravens in a winner-take-all challenge. At stake, the AFC North Championship title and a spot in the playoffs.
Now, we football fans often joke that the NFL is so full of drama that it must be scripted, but what happened in the fourth quarter was stranger than fiction. And to be clear, as someone who lives in Baltimore, I would rather not relive this. With less than a minute remaining and the Steelers down by four, quarterback Aaron Rodgers launched a touchdown pass to take the lead.
And my condolences, Juana, because what I have to tell you is that then...
The extra point from Boswell. Twisting. No good! No good! He missed the extra point!
Yes, Steelers kicker Chris Boswell missed the extra point, usually a gimme, putting the Steelers up by only two and putting the Ravens... just a field goal away from winning the game, the division title, and, oh, yeah, a spot in the playoffs.
And the Ravens marched back down the field with 2 seconds left. Their rookie kicker, Tyler Loop, stepped up to the line for a 44-yard attempt.
Snap good. Holden. The kick is no good. It is wide right. And the Steelers are the champions of the North.
And with Baltimore's missed kick, Pittsburgh once again snuck into the playoffs.
NBC Sports commentator Mike Tirico was quick to point out something bigger might have been at play.
I want to show you what happened pregame at 6:15 local time. This is a priest who is spreading holy water in that end zone.
53 years ago, the Steelers were on the receiving end of the Immaculate Reception. Last night, it looked like they may have received some divine intervention.
Yeah, that's your story in Baltimore, Juana. You can't make this stuff up.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
It is 4:18, and you're listening to All Things Considered here on KAXE, KBXE. Coming up next is your Daily Dose of Phenology, where John Latimer looks back at his nature notes from this date. We receive support from Bemidji Brewing, offering rotating taproom exclusive beers and crowlers to go. The latest offerings available Tuesday through Thursday, 2 p.m. to 10 p.m., Friday and Saturday, 11 a.m. to 10 p.m., and Sunday, 11 a.m. to 7 p.m. More at BemidjiBeer.com. Bemidji Beer, nice catch.
On today's date, January 5th, 2009, my neighbor reports spotting a snowy owl. I am struck with envy because I have not seen a snowy owl since the early 60s, and it is a long-time fervent hope that I will one day see another snowy owl. They are not regular denizens of northern Minnesota. They come in the winter when things are tough in their native territory, which is far north, above the tree line. And the fact that they come from such a far northern expanse means that when they are here, they hunt day and night because from their home range, they're used to 24 hours of daylight. So hunting in broad daylight is no problem for them. And they are also not familiar with forests, so you seldom see them in the woods. Most often, they are hunting from a fence post or from the ground in a broad open field. It is just what they're familiar with. Keep your eyes peeled this winter. Maybe, just maybe, you'll see a snowy owl.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from your part-time controller, specializing in nonprofit accounting and committed to supporting nonprofits with financial management services such as budgeting and forecasting. YPTC.com/NPR. From Americans United for Separation of Church and State, since 1946, AU has supported the First Amendment right of freedom of religion. More at AU.org. And from the listeners who support this NPR station.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. Nicolas Maduro, ousted president of Venezuela, pleaded not guilty to drug trafficking and other charges in a U.S. federal court in Manhattan today. In a brief appearance, Maduro told the judge, quote, "I'm innocent. I am not guilty. I am a decent man." Just 2 days earlier, Maduro was captured in a U.S. military raid in Caracas, bringing an end to his nearly 13 years in power. As John Otis reports, Maduro was an accidental president who led Venezuela into disaster.
Para todos y para todas, lo juro.
That's Nicolás Maduro being sworn in as president in 2013 following the death of Hugo Chávez, the founder of Venezuela's socialist revolution. Maduro had been Chavez's vice president and closest advisor.
Maduro is a very outgoing guy. He makes jokes all the time.
That's Andres Izarra, who served for 2 years as Maduro's tourism minister. But he notes that Maduro lacked Chavez's leadership skills and that to maintain power, he became more authoritarian. Maduro even joked about his resemblance to one of the world's most notorious dictators. Sometimes when I look in the mirror, I see Stalin, he quipped in this 2017 broadcast. Maduro had previously worked as a bus driver and union activist before jumping into politics. He had no formal training in economics, and it quickly showed, says John Polga Hekimovich, a Venezuela scholar at the U.S. Naval Academy.
He's someone who oversaw the complete destruction of the economy.
Under Maduro, government corruption and mismanagement, followed by U.S. sanctions, caused Venezuela's vital oil industry to collapse. That drove up poverty and led to widespread food shortages. The government printed more money, but that spurred hyperinflation. Eventually, one quarter of the Venezuelan population fled the country in what's considered the largest exodus in modern Latin American history. Many of those who stayed behind took to the streets in protest. But Maduro responded with massive military crackdowns. Opponents were jailed and sometimes tortured. The International Criminal Court opened an investigation against the Maduro regime for crimes against humanity. He stayed in power in part through fraud-marred elections. Here's Maduro claiming victory in the 2024 presidential election, despite widespread evidence that the opposition won by an overwhelming margin. Javier Corrales, a Venezuela expert at Amherst College, says Maduro also gave massive perks to the military, promoted businesses loyal to his government, and used a shadow fleet of tankers to skirt U.S. oil sanctions.
The survival of Maduro and the skills that he deployed in order to stay in office will be studied, I think, in years to come.
But in his second term, President Trump turned up the pressure. He accused Maduro of drug trafficking and of stealing U.S. oil assets. He sent warships to the Caribbean and warned Maduro to step down or face the consequences. Yet, in some of his last public appearances, Maduro joked and sang along to John Lennon's Imagine in garbled English.
Imagine us people.
In the end, Izarra, the former tourism minister who broke with Maduro 10 years ago, says Maduro may have been betrayed by someone on the inside, paving the way for the dramatic overnight snatch operation. He now has only scorn for his former boss.
What is his legacy? We have become an American protectorate thanks to Maduro. We are the new Puerto Rico.
Trump now says that the U.S. is in charge, and he has warned interim president Delcy Rodriguez that if she doesn't cooperate, she'll face a fate worse than Maduro's. For NPR News, I'm John Otis.
The U.S. military operation in Venezuela is having ripple effects a world away. Israel praised the attack, hoping this could be another pressure point on Iran and one of its proxies, Hezbollah, which had deep ties with Nicolas Maduro's government. NPR's Michelle Kellerman reports on the potential impact on the Middle East.
Reichman University professor Mayer Javadanfar has been glued to social media, watching the protest movement in Iran, where he was born, from Tel Aviv, where he lives now. We meet in a cafe near his home.
It's a very special time to be Iranian-Israeli. My Iranian compatriots in Tehran are risking their life and going to the streets to fight, to have democracy. And meanwhile, me and many of my Israeli compatriots are going every week to protests to maintain our liberal democracy, which is under threat from the current government.
But while he's a critic of Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's domestic policies, Javadanfar backs Israel's tough position on Iran. And he thinks the operation in Venezuela could add more pressure on the Iranian regime. He says the Iranian-backed Lebanese militant group Hezbollah made money in the drug trade from Venezuela to Europe, which meant it relied a bit less on Iranian handouts in recent years.
That's going to go. I don't think the Americans are going to stand for it. So that means that Hezbollah is now going to become even more dependent on Iran for its income. And I think this comes at a very precarious time for Iran's economy.
And the protest movement in Iran is all about the economy.
The Iranian economy is so maligned. It is so sick. It is so bedridden with the problem of inflation that even if the current protests end, it's not going to solve it.
Iranians in exile are worried about a crackdown on protesters while the world is focusing on Venezuela. President Trump has warned Iran that the U.S. is, quote, locked and loaded if the Iranians kill peaceful protesters. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, just back from a meeting with Trump, says he thinks the Iranian people are taking their fate in their own hands. His spokesperson, Shash Bedrosian, says Netanyahu was also pleased with the operation to oust Maduro in Venezuela.
Now, the foreign ministry has actually said that Venezuela has destabilized the region there, serving as a base for Hezbollah terror operatives and hosting Iranian weapons production facilities.
But she wouldn't say if Israel has been given any assurances from the Trump administration or from the remnants of the Maduro regime that they will break ranks with Iran. Secretary of State Marco Rubio also wouldn't describe his conversations about this with the Venezuelans, but he told NBC's Meet the Press that the U.S. expects Venezuela to stop cozying up to Hezbollah and Iran.
You can't turn Venezuela into the operating hub for Iran, for Russia, for Hezbollah, for China, for the Cuban intelligence agents that control that country. That cannot continue.
Hezbollah, Hamas, and Iran are among those condemning the U.S. military action in Venezuela and what they call a kidnapping of President Maduro. Hezbollah's statement accused the U.S. of, quote, a hegemonic, arrogant, and piracy-driven approach to the world in support of its protege, Israel. The U.S. ambassador to Israel, Mike Huckabee, says taking down Maduro is good news for the Middle East, half a world away. Michelle Kellerman, NPR News, Tel Aviv.
This is NPR News.
It is 4:29, and you're listening to All Things Considered here on member-supported radio, KAXE, KBXE. I'm Andrew DeZingle. Coming up next is National Native News. We receive support from the First National Bank of Coleraine since 1906, serving the needs of the community and working with their friends and neighbors, with branches in Coleraine and Grand Rapids. More information at coleranebank.com, member FDIC. Listen to the Season Watch Pod with hosts Charlie Mitchell, Heidi Holton, John Latimer, and a rotating cast of characters. Season Watch Pod, for the curious, filled with the delights of nature. New episodes Thursdays. Happy Dancing Turtle invites all ages to participate in their winter bingo scavenger hunt, now until January 15th. Look for 24 items on your bingo card with a special focus on animal tracks. Find a registration link and more details at happydancingturtle.org. Now it's time for National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Monday is the deadline for the public to weigh in on a potential rule change by the EPA that could impact which water bodies may be protected from pollution. As KJZZ's Gabriel Pietrazzo reports, tribes are among those asking for a 30-day extension to comment.
WOTUS, or the Waters of the United States, guides which resources fall under the Federal Clean Water Act. But as written, the EPA would narrow the law's enforcement, with estimates suggesting that 80% of the nation's wetlands could be at risk.
I think it's a big picture concern for everyone, really. Most tribes who want clean water or the ability to make sure that water is usable are probably going to write in opposition to kind of what the rule stands for.
Daniel Cordalis is Diné and runs the nonprofit Tribal Water Institute. While tribes can regulate waters on their reservations, they lack jurisdiction elsewhere.
Tribes can't look to the EPA anymore. I mean, arguably, federal governments have to protect these tribal resources, but who's going to do that?
Some states are stepping up, like Colorado, New Mexico, and Arizona.
That we're coordinating with our neighbors, tribes or states or country on our southern border, to make sure that we each know what each other is doing.
Trevor Bagori is the Water Quality Division Director at the Arizona Department of Environmental Quality.
Hopefully this new rule will add some clarity, as long as they are able to provide scientific tools to help us determine what's regulated and what's not.
For National Native News, I'm Gabriel Pietrazzo.
Attendance at a school near the Pine Ridge and Rosebud reservations has nearly doubled in the past 3 years. School leaders say they're engaging one-on-one with students and families. They're also implementing Lakota language and culture. South Dakota Searchlight's Megan O'Brien has more.
It'd be like a herd of horses coming in.
There you are. Where you been?
This is a typical morning at Norris Elementary, where most of the students are Native American. Principal Brian Brown greets students and staff at the cafeteria tables as breakfast is served. Brown also asks teachers who's missing. It's a way of getting ahead of the problem, he says. When students aren't at school, he makes phone calls and home visits. Just 3 years ago, barely half the students came to school regularly. Now, the school's attendance rate is above 90%. That's higher than the state average. It's a source of pride for Brown, who took over as principal in 2022.
I was very happy. I was very pleased. But more proud of the kids and the parents for their support and believing in Norris.
The leader of South Dakota's education department sees the success at Norris. The leadership and cultural engagement are important parts of that, Joseph Graves says.
And so now we want to see what kind of results this produces. We have the attendance, we have the drops in chronic absenteeism. Now we want to see what's going to happen with those proficiency rates and the graduation rates.
The school is on a gravel road about a half hour from other schools in the White River School District. Its isolation makes it difficult to hire and recruit teachers. In a small community, it takes everyone to keep students involved, Brown says. Some teachers have multiple grade levels in one classroom. The school's head custodian and office administrator are also bus drivers, and Brown steps in at lunchtime to help serve food. He also finds ways to make Lakota culture and language an important part of every student's day. Students sing every morning. Brown teaches Lakota studies to each grade once a week and started the school's first drum group, the Black Pipe Singers. For National Native News, I'm Megan O'Brien.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation, with funding by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Tribal Development Partners, helping tribes build toward their goals through 105L leasing and essential facility development. Empowering sovereignty, strengthening community. More at tribaldevpartners.com, proud supporters of this show. Skugtash.
For more than 40 years, Ramona Farms has revived ancient traditional foods. Tepary beans, pinoli, polentas, and more, all from store.ramonafarms.com. Ramona Farms supports this show. Om Ye.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from the Wallace Foundation, an independent, nonpartisan research foundation collaborating with grantees and partners in the arts, school leadership, and youth development. More at wallacefoundation.org. From the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, RWJF is a national philanthropy working toward a future where health is no longer a privilege, but a right. Learn more at rwjf.org. And from the Doris Duke Foundation.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. Ousted Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro and his wife, Celia Flores, landed by helicopter on the New York City waterfront today, where they were escorted to a Manhattan courtroom, a courtroom surrounded by protesters. NPR immigration correspondent Jasmine Gartz was there in that Manhattan courtroom watching as Maduro pleaded not guilty to federal criminal charges. Jasmine is here now. Hey there.
Hi.
Tell us more what actually happened in court today.
It was a bizarre scene inside the courthouse. Maduro was wearing his prison uniform, and as he walked out, he kept looking at reporters in the eye and wishing them a happy new year in English. When he was asked by the judge to identify himself, Maduro did so as the president of Venezuela. And he also said he's a prisoner of war who has been kidnapped by the U.S. He and his wife, Celia Flores, pleaded not guilty to all of the charges, from narco-terrorism to weapons crimes.
Right. Flores, his wife, also, as you mentioned, stands accused of various charges, drug trafficking, etc. Did she say anything?
She was mostly quiet. She introduced herself as the First Lady of Venezuela, but it was her appearance that was really striking. Her eye seemed swollen. Her forehead was bandaged in what lawyers, her lawyers, said was an injury sustained during the U.S. military operation that happened this past Saturday. They asked for medical attention, both for Maduro and for Celia Flores. Now, overall, I'd say the proceedings were tense. As it wrapped up, Maduro was escorted out, and a heckler stood up and said, "You will pay in the name of the Venezuelan people." Maduro turned around and said to him, "I'm a man of God."
A man of God. So he sounds confident, unbowed. He's going to fight these charges. We mentioned protests outside the courtroom today. Tell me more about those.
So by the time Maduro appeared in court, there was a sizable crowd outside, protesters and counter-protesters. On the one hand, you had this contingent protesting American intervention in Venezuela. I met one young man, Ebtisham Ahmed, who said, "This should alarm all Americans.
None of these wars go to benefit the people of the United States. They take away, you know, funding for healthcare, funding for education, funding for, you know, so other social services, and direct it to buying new weapons, to buying bombs. And we've seen this story play out in Iraq, Afghanistan, Vietnam, and Libya. And the U.S., it seems like, is on track to do it again in Venezuela."
But there was also a very emotional crowd of Venezuelans decked out in flags, cheering for the arrest of Maduro and confronting those who were calling for his release. I met a woman named Maria Su, who's been in the U.S. for about 10 years. She pointed at those protesters, and this is what she said to me.
Y están aquí haciendo eso. ¿Tú sabes por qué? Porque esto es un país libre de expresión, donde tú puedes hacerlo. Me encantaría que ellos fueran a Venezuela y trataran de hacer eso allá y de expresarse en contra de Maduro, a ver qué les pasa.
And what she's saying is, you know why they get to protest? Because this is a free country with freedom of speech. I'd like to see them try to protest against Maduro in Venezuela and see what happens.
So where does the case against Maduro and Celia Flores, where does it go from here?
This is going to be a long, long battle. The next hearing is going to be on March 17th. Meanwhile, Maduro and his wife are going to remain in jail here in New York City until then.
NPR's Jasmine Gartz in New York. Thank you, Jasmine.
Thank you.
The Trump administration has announced a major change to federal recommendations for protecting children against infectious diseases. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention sharply scaled back the number of recommended routine childhood vaccinations today. NPR health correspondent Rob Stein is here with us to tell us more. Hi.
Hey there, Juana.
Rob, I mean, this sounds like a really major change. Walk us through it. What exactly did the Trump administration announce?
Yeah, this is an unprecedented shift, Juana. The Health and Human Services Department announced that the CDC was essentially ripping up the childhood vaccination schedule, triggering outrage among many public health experts. Here's Dr. Sean O'Leary from the American Academy of Pediatrics.
My colleagues in other countries are looking at what is happening here in the U.S. in horror. These decisions matter. Literally, children's health and children's lives are at stake. We should all be alarmed.
The childhood vaccine schedule is basically the blueprint that doctors follow to protect children against a long list of diseases, including measles, meningitis, polio, and the flu. It influences all kinds of things, like, you know, the shots kids need to go to school, and is considered responsible for largely conquering terrible diseases in this country that had long plagued children.
Rob, tell us how exactly the CDC changed the vaccination schedule.
The old schedule had recommended all kids get shots to protect them against 17 diseases. Now it's 11. The CDC is mirroring the vaccine schedule used in Denmark, which recommends universal vaccination against just 10 diseases. The new U.S. version is slightly more expansive. It adds chickenpox, and the CDC still recommends vaccinating all kids against 11 diseases, including polio, measles, and pneumonia. But the new schedule no longer recommends routine immunization against diseases like meningitis, RSV, rotavirus, hepatitis, and the flu. Those shots are now only recommended for kids at high risk for those diseases and only after consulting with a healthcare professional.
And what is the rationale for this?
So the administration officials argue that this brings the U.S. in line with other similar countries and came after comparing the U.S. to 20 other countries and conducting what they say was a comprehensive scientific assessment. President Trump ordered that review. The officials say this will help restore public trust in vaccines and question whether there's been enough good research to make sure the vaccines are safe and so many shots are really necessary. You know, we got to remember, Health Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. has long questioned the safety and effectiveness of many vaccines.
That's right. And Rob, you mentioned earlier that public health experts are outraged by this move. What have you heard from them?
Yeah, you know, I should say the move is being welcomed by those who question vaccines. But as we heard earlier, the change is being condemned by many infectious disease experts and, you know, major medical groups. They argue that Denmark is the outlier, not the U.S. Denmark is a very different country, much smaller, with a much better health care system and much better social support. The approach the U.S. had followed for years is actually much more in line with most other similar countries, you know, like the U.K., Canada, and places like Germany.
Last thing, what exactly are their concerns about this change?
Yeah, critics say their decision will only increase distrust in vaccines, not dispel it, and that could cause childhood vaccination rates to fall even more. And while administration officials say the vaccines will still be free for anyone who wants them, many public health experts say the changes may still make it harder for parents to get their kids vaccinated if they want to, because some doctors, for example, may now stop stocking many vaccines. So the fear is this will bring back many diseases at a time when infections like measles and whooping cough are already resurging.
NPR health correspondent Rob Stein, thank you.
You bet, Juana.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
You're tuned in to All Things Considered here on KAXE KBXE, People Powered Radio. My name is Andrew DeZingle. Coming up next is North Star Stories. Support for this program comes from Sanford Health, with primary care locations in Bemidji and across the Upper Midwest. Sanford Health is committed to providing care close to home. Learn more at sanfordhealth.org. The Winter Lecture Series continues at the Forest History Center in Grand Rapids, Saturday, January 17th at 1 p.m. Author Pete Cairo will talk about innovations in mine land management that have led to ecological restoration. The Cohasset Parks and Rec Department has snowshoe hikes at Tioga Recreation Area on Mondays and Thursdays at 1:30. Meet at the bike trail parking lot. The city will provide snowshoes if you don't have them. All experience levels welcome. And don't forget our question of the week. What are you looking forward to this year? Text us at 218-326-1234. Now for North Star Stories.
You are listening to North Star Stories, Voices from Where We Live, a daily newscast about what it means to live in Minnesota.
Today, some of the state's law students from tribal nations receive top honors. Then, renters in northern Minnesota are seeing the results of a new first-of-its-kind law in our state. And candlelight winter walks return to Minnesota state parks. I'm Gracie J. 9 law students who represent the state's tribal nations and communities received student achievements and scholarships from the Minnesota Native American Bar Association, or MNABA. MNABA says the awards highlight a growing commitment to Native representation, legal education, and future leadership in tribal and public service law. All the students attend the Mitchell Hamlin School of Law, located in St. Paul, which has the nation's largest enrollment of Native law students. In today's main story, just 2 months after a first-of-its-kind law in northeastern Minnesota, citizens are already seeing its effect, and it's hitting close to home. Frankie Felagi has the report.
When Cody Pals moved to Duluth in 2019, he had to wait 2 years for a hot shower. Now, thanks to the new Right to Repair law, he only has to wait 2 weeks. The first city in Minnesota to pass such a law, Right to Repair gives property owners 2 weeks to respond to maintenance requests. If they don't, tenants can fix it themselves or hire the labor out and have that bill taken off their next month's rent. The bill covers repairs up to $500 or 50% of monthly rent, whichever is higher. Cody Pals is a renter and leader with the Duluth Tenants Union. He says the law is just common sense for both tenants and property owners.
You'd think you would want that, right? You would want somebody to maintain their properties.
Since the law was passed in November, his landlord fixed his broken dishwasher within a few days, a rarity before Right to Repair, he says.
It's not very typical. It takes a couple times to get them to respond or get them to come out. Why do I have to be annoying to get this done? It's what I deserve. I pay full rent. I need a fully repaired unit.
Property manager Michael Garmer works with Condo and Home Advisors LLC out of Duluth. He manages over 100 properties, leasing and handling maintenance requests. Garmer says that since the bill passed, his company hasn't seen a huge impact on his tenants or owners so far. He says he deals with requests in a timely manner, but he does see how the Right to Repair law can be a massive change for his neighbors.
If you're a private landlord that didn't use a management company and was maybe a little more lackadaisical on taking care of your tenant requests, it's going to make it easier for tenants of those private landlords or those large companies that have, let's call it, over 1,000 units, where they can't be as responsive and quick. It will help those tenants.
Tenants like Chloe Holloway, who rents in East Duluth. Years ago, a leak in her kitchen caused a buildup of mold.
And then one night, the ceiling was so rotten and moldy that my finger went through it while I was cleaning it. It was horrific. And it started, chunks started falling on my face. It was a freaking nightmare.
She says it took half a year for her landlord to get it fixed. She led door-knocking efforts that garnered almost 6,000 signatures to get the Right to Repair measure on the ballot. Now that it's passed, Holloway says there's more work to do.
Now we just got to make sure people know that it passed and know that they can use it and how to use it.
How to use it. Notify your landlord in writing that you intend to use the Right to Repair law. Then wait 2 weeks. If they don't respond, schedule or do the repair. If you hire out, just make sure to choose someone with a proper license. Keep the receipts and deduct the cost from your rent. For North Star Stories, I'm Frankie Fulegi.
You are listening to North Star Stories.
Minnesotans are invited to bundle up and head outdoors this winter as candlelight events return to state parks and trails across the state. This winter, the Minnesota Department of Natural Resources, or DNR, has scheduled 20 candlelight events at 17 locations statewide between January 1st and February 28th. The nighttime events let visitors hike, snowshoe, or cross-country ski along luminary-lit trails depending on snow conditions. A full list of dates, locations, and details is available on the DNR's Candlelight Hike website. Page.
North Star Stories is produced by Ambers, diverse radio for Minnesota's communities, with support from the McKnight Foundation and the state of Minnesota, online at ambers.org.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Juana Summers. If you are a journalist, you want to be the first to break a major news story, to get the scoop. And Saturday's early morning raid on Venezuela by U.S. troops to seize President Nicolas Maduro, that obviously counts as pretty big news. The Trump White House and the Pentagon have routinely attacked the mainstream media as irresponsible. Yet, as U.S. Secretary of State Marco Rubio told ABC News yesterday, the press showed restraint on this.
Frankly, a number of media outlets had gotten leaks that this was coming and held it for that very reason. And we thank them for doing that, or lives could have been lost.
NPR's David Folkenflik joins us now to explain some key elements of the reporting on the story. Hi there.
Hey, Juana.
Hey, so Secretary Rubio on ABC News mentioned leaks. Tell us what he was referring to.
Well, look, all administrations, all Defense Department hate leaks. They work to counteract it and they investigate it, what have you. Under Secretary Pete Hegseth, the DOD is exceptionally leak averse to the point where, he put up policies that would essentially strip credentials from reporters who didn't agree to not go asking for unauthorized information to be let out. In this case, these do not appear to have been briefings from the Pentagon or leaks that were officially sanctioned. Reporters were not warned, as sometimes happens, to stay close to their desk, close to home, something might happen. In this case, it appears that reporters were working their sources inside the U.S. military and other institutions and leaning on colleagues and sources, in fact, inside Venezuela as to what was happening. As Semaphore first reported, the New York Times and the Washington Post knew about this either as or before it was happening, at CBS News as well.
So why then the delay in reporting?
Well, they certainly ended up having to publish some hours later than perhaps they could have. Let's acknowledge information isn't fully clear, and that's, sometimes stories aren't fully baked. Obviously, people in Caracas knew there was a firefight and some sort of attack as it occurred, but coverage there is typically tightly controlled. There is risk for reporting there. Very few visas given to Western reporters. So you see Western and American outlets having to rely often on anonymous stringers there. Let's give an example. Some years ago, CBS's Matt Gutman, then with ABC, was held for 5 days by Venezuelan Secret Service for his reporting there. Mm-hmm. It's an indication of how tightly things are controlled. We got a statement from an Associated Press News executive named Paul Byrne. He said, one of our reporters hearing the strikes firsthand, meaning in Caracas, helped us break the story in real time. Byrne said that having people there in Venezuela lets them get the testimony and voices of those most affected out. But let's also acknowledge a tradition. As Rubio suggested, mainstream news organizations don't want to jeopardize the lives of American armed forces and personnel in the midst of military operations, and you see holding back as a result.
That's right. And as I mentioned, as you've reported, this administration has typically attacked the mainstream media. What has its stance been here so far?
Well, you've seen President Trump taking a victory lap in interviews with the New York Times, The Atlantic, and others. You've seen Rubio and others going on Sunday morning talk shows. But there has been assailing criticism it has received in the mainstream media over unanswered questions like, what are the motivations? Who's going to lead Venezuela? Will there be American forces there? Hegseth and others hate those questions, but they're important ones.
In the last 30 seconds we have left, given all of this, just sum it up for us. What do you make of the way that the press has handled the news of Maduro's capture?
Well, they're seeking, since reporting on this, to compensate for the failure of transparency by the administration, the lack of notification to Capitol Hill. You've heard questions from places like Columbia Journalism Review. Should news organizations withhold such information, even in the question of risk of lives? But covering unfolding events, as I suggested, can be messy. And in this case, major mainstream news outlets sought to show that they could be responsible and authoritative as events unfolded.
NPR's David Folkenflik, thank you.
You bet.
To Minnesota, because today Democratic Governor Tim Walz announced he will not run for a third term. Allegations of fraud in the state related to COVID-era programs have again focused national attention on Walz. He was, of course, the former Democratic vice presidential candidate. Here he is earlier today
I came to the conclusion that I can't give a political campaign my all. Every minute that I spend defending my own political interest would be a minute I can't spend defending the people of Minnesota.
Perhaps his loudest critic has been President Trump. In response to the fraud allegations, the Trump administration is freezing some federal funding in the state and across the country. Dana Ferguson is a political correspondent at Minnesota Public Radio. Hey there, Dana.
Hey, Mary Louise.
How else did Walz explain this decision today, not to run for re-election as governor?
Yeah, he said that the buck stops with him when it comes to fraud in state programs. And this isn't a new issue here. State officials, including Walz, investigators and prosecutors, have been dealing with this for years. But the federal government has really spotlighted it over the course of just the last few weeks. In the press conference today, Walz laid into President Trump, saying his administration's move to pause child care funding is hurting Minnesota families. And he says the president's comments about Somali people alleged to have engaged in fraud are harmful. Ultimately, Walz said running for another term would pull him away from the work of rooting out fraud in government programs.
Okay, you said Governor Walz laid into President Trump today. What's President Trump saying about this?
Yeah, Trump came out on Truth Social today celebrating the news that Walz won't run again. Trump said Walz had destroyed the state of Minnesota and went on to say no one is above the law. In the last few weeks, Trump has dispatched several federal agencies to investigate fraud in the state and has cut off some loans and child care payments for folks here. His administration alleges federal programs have been subject to fraud. The administration has also moved to freeze federal child care funding across the country.
And just to focus us on Minnesota and take President Trump and his administration out of this for a sec, the significance of Walz's departure from this race for governor.
Yeah, it's a big deal. Walz has been in the office for almost 8 years. Before that, he represented southern Minnesota in Congress, and he gained national attention for running as vice president alongside Kamala Harris in 2024. He also had a huge war chest for his campaign. More than a dozen Republicans here have filed to challenge Governor Walz, and they all really counted on the vulnerability around this issue of fraud. Now that he's stepped aside, a new Democratic candidate could come forward who doesn't have the same sort of baggage.
And do we have any names being floated yet for who that new Democratic candidate might be?
Well, we have at least one. U.S. Senator Amy Klobuchar is weighing a bid. She would be a strong contender because she's been in office almost 2 decades and has strong name recognition. We haven't heard other Democrats shift lanes to run at this point, but that could happen in the next few days. No matter who emerges as a Democratic candidate, Republicans have consistently said they'll essentially just be like an extension of Governor Walz's term. And they say Democrats broadly allowed for fraud, so they should be held accountable. And they say the office needs a shakeup. One of the first steps we have here in Minnesota to pick candidates is called precinct caucuses. And those are just a month away, so candidates kind of need to figure things out here in a hurry.
Thank you, Dana.
You're welcome.
It's Dana Ferguson with Minnesota Public Radio. And again, the news today, Democratic Governor Tim Walz announcing he will not run for a third term.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Progressive Insurance, working to help protect small businesses and the owners that run them, offering customizable coverages to salons, accounting firms, tradespeople, and more. Learn more at progressivecommercial.com. From Melville Charitable Trust, committed to ensuring all people have a safe, stable, and affordable home that allows them to thrive. Information about ways to prevent and solve homelessness is at melvilletrust.org. And from Workday, an AI platform to manage HR, finance, and agents that aims to free business leaders from the mundane so they can focus on more meaningful work. Workday, moving business forever forward.
This is 91.7 KAXE Grand Rapids, 90.5 KBXE Bagley Bemidji, 89.9 Brainerd, and on your smart speaker. We are People Powered Radio in northern Minnesota. Join us at kaxe.org. Support for KAXE comes from Woodworks Homes, dedicated to the art of building in northern Minnesota by constructing handcrafted new homes and offering remodeling services. More at woodworksmn.com. Northland Arboretum in Baxter is offering forest ice skating during daylight hours. Explore a gently winding trail through the woods with light elevation changes. The Arboretum is currently accepting donations of ice skates, especially kids and men's sizes. Looking at weather tonight, cloudy skies, overnight lows 15 to 20 degrees with chance of widespread dense freezing fog, chance of freezing rain, and a winter weather advisory in Crow Wing.